from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks so much for being here, everybody. So how many of you remember the first time you fell in love? I do. He was tall, dark, handsome, seriously ripped. A little uncommunicative, maybe on the mysterious side. His name was Batman. I'm not kidding, really. Batman was my first crush. I was 5, 6 years old, and I used to watch him on TV every week. But you know, first crushes wear off, infatuations kind of go away, and I moved on to somebody much, much hotter. Catwoman. How do you explain the crazy randomness of who we fall for? You know, why is it that some crushes burn out while others grow into shared romance and lasting intimacy? Well, today we're going to see if science, and in particular evolution, can help unravel one of the greatest mysteries in the world, love. So where should we begin? How about sex? Our first guest today is a biologist who has devoted her life to laying bare the mysteries of sex in the animal kingdom. Her name is Dr. Karen Bondar. You have maybe seen her on her web series, Wild Sex, or caught her on Discovery World, National Geographic, the Science Channel. Karen is relentless in her pursuit of the science behind wild animal sex, and amazingly inventive in how she communicates it. So please welcome Dr. Karen Bondar.
Hi, thank you so much. It is my pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you. So yeah, I'm here to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that are maybe not as pretty as pure love might be. So I'd like to get you thinking about animals having sex in a way that maybe you haven't before. And that's because I think a lot of people don't realize that sex for animals, much like it is for us, is a process. I like to think about sex as having three phases. First, you've got to meet or find that potential partner. Hopefully many of you are here tonight on dates. And chances are you didn't simply identify the person that you're with as a member of the opposite sex, walk up to them and start copulating. Well, why would you think animals do it any differently? They have to decide whether or not a potential partner is going to be worthy of them, whether they're compatible, and there are many ways that animals court each other and try to convince each other to have sex with them. Then, of course, you have to have the sex. And then lastly, you've got to deal with the aftermath of your sexual conquests, and that is dealing with the offspring. So let's think about meeting someone. Humans kind of think that we have it pretty rough. Cities are big. How am I supposed to get out there and find that perfect guy or that perfect girl? But we actually have some pretty good strategies for finding a mate. We have online dating, clubs, friends of friends. We have lots of ways that we can communicate, first of all, that we're looking, and second of all, that we're interested in somebody. Animals have a lot of ways to do this too. There are songs, there are dances, there are smells, there's a whole lot of things. But one thing about big cities is that we're actually interfering quite a bit with the ways in which animals can meet each other. I mean, in large urban centers, birds can't hear each other. And in fact, many male songbirds in urban centers end up being unpaired during the mating season. But in the context of evolution, other males are evolving different ways to sing, using different note patterns at different frequencies. And certain grasshoppers are actually using different parts of their bodies to make noises that are entirely different than they would have otherwise. All of these things in an effort to be heard in an environment that they didn't evolve with all of this noise. So very interesting. So let's talk about the sex. One of the most perverse one of the most perverse strategies in the animal kingdom is that of sexual cannibalism. And I'm going to let this little ditty speak for itself. Here we have two praying mantids. We have the female on the front, the male on her back. She has just gone ahead and interrupted, well, his fun, ripping off his head. She is now eating his head. But you will notice, and this is the important bit, his body is continuing to have sex with her. Mm-hmm. And so you're probably saying, well, Dr. Bondar, how is he supposed to get his genes into future generations if he's dead? And that is a good question, a valid question. But in this particular case, and in many cases where sexual cannibalism is a thing, there are valid reasons for it. In many cases, a manted male won't get very many chances to have sex. And it makes a lot of sense for him to have sex with a female, especially if she's a virgin, because he can then be having sex with her continuously while she is busy eating his head, and his sperm will have a greater amount of time to reach her ovaries. And chances are he will be successful at reproducing here. So I wish I had more time. I could tell you about head-stabbing penises and all the rest, but I must move on to phase three, which is the aftermath. And in our species, we tend to engage in our offspring a lot. But motherhood in the animal kingdom is a very complicated job. And birds do this wonderful thing for us to enable us to study them. They create eggs, mothers do, which are these beautiful little packages of nutrients and hormones and all kinds of goodies that they directly provide to a certain offspring. And sometimes dad can be a little less than desirable. And so biologists studying allocation of resources in female birds use this system in particular, the blue-footed booby, because we all know that blue-footed booby males have these gorgeous blue feet, and that's what the females use to choose a particular guy. And they also have a really interesting mating system. The male and the female will copulate, and the female will immediately lay one egg. 72 hours later, she'll lay another one from that same copulation. So biologists went ahead, and in between the laying of her two eggs, they painted his feet a dull gray. I know, poor guy. But interestingly, this is astounding. When the second egg came along, it was much smaller, had fewer hormones and fewer sugars. So she was able to interpret this difference in the mating partner and ascribe her resources accordingly. That is all the time that I have, but thank you so much for your attention.
That was Dr. Karen Bondar. She's a biologist, author of the book Wild Sex. You can currently see her on the Discovery Channel's Outrageous Acts of Science. Next up, storyteller and moth host, Dasha Kelly Hamilton.
Orgasm is like catching a fly. You hear it before you see it. You're not really sure where it's coming from, that buzz, maybe behind the curtain or inside the lampshade. You hear it, and then you don't. So you go back to doing whatever it was you were doing, folding, scribbling, pumping, nothing complicated, just what you do. And then you hear it. So now you're focused. You know a promise when you hear one. So you follow that sound as it curls itself around ribbons of air and weaves in between sonic waves. You can hear it taunting you, Marco to your polo, dissonance to your solo. You can even feel it tickling the prickles of your flesh without ever touching your skin. And then you see it, this erratic spasm defying rhythm and space. It's the choreography you had to teach yourself over the years because you weren't real good at that fly-catching business when you were much younger. When you were younger, it was all wild flailing and crazy swinging, chasing around tiny flies with newspapers, envelopes, raggedy house shoes, whatever you can put your hands to until indignity melted into exhaustion and you resigned yourself to simply wait, praying that bliss might find its way to your toe, land on your shoulder, or God help you, kiss the inside of your thigh. Until that one time, that one night, you were listening to a buzz of a siren song and you wanted to sing songs too. So you knew you had to decide. And And with that one action, it's like someone releasing red droplets of ink onto naked strips of rice paper. Rich color pulling towards your uncolored stretches, dragging itself towards your untouched edges. And this is called desire. And when you have that red color coursing through your veins, you're gonna catch that fly. No matter how, no matter who's watching and what they may think, if you have to twist your face into unflattering expressions, you are gonna catch that fly. If you have to growl nasty language through clenched teeth, you are catching that motherfucking fly. If you have to jerk and twist your body into unnatural positions, you are gonna catch that fly. And when you do, that weightless insect will feel like a 2-ton rhino wrestled into submission, victory in the palm of your hands. So you drop it, because it's nasty. Little girls don't catch flies, especially not in the palm of your hand. So you drop it and raise a white flag to every unfounded declaration of what good girls don't do. Convincing that warrior princess inside of you to ignore her Serengeti soundtrack and the taste of gazelles we once hauled between our teeth. You are a huntress by heritage, but they told you it was nasty, left you standing, and now we have these shadows crying on our bedroom walls. Their tears trying to wash away the memory of wide open freedoms and understood hunger, and we are still left standing trying to smudge away gummy carcasses and black lace wings from the palms of our hands, trying to smudge away the nasty like they told us. But this hunger is deeper than etiquette. It's stronger than liberation. Sexuality imprints its own genome patterned into the puzzle of your spine. Did you think it was an accident? The way desire grabs and pulls at your uncolored edges, orgasmic pleasure is your birthright. Warrior queen? So let's rise up. We have to rise up. We need to rise up and hunt the way our grandmothers instructed in their etchings on mountainsides and tree roots and soft-toned cave walls. We need to take to the buzzing killing fields. But before we pick up our swords and our shields, we have to grab hands, bow our heads, and make a solemn pledge to teach our daughters to catch more flies.
She is amazing. She is a force of nature. That is the multi-talented Dasha Kelly Hamilton. She's a storyteller, performance artist, poet, novelist, and she also hosts The Moth, storytelling on stage at the High Noon Saloon in Madison. Speaking of ingenious organisms, we've got our musical guest this hour I wanted to introduce. This is Luke Baziner, who goes by the stage name of Asimaya. And all right, take it away.
What's your name now? What's your name now? What's your name now? What you wanna be called? What's your name now? What's your name now? What's your name now? Do you wanna be called?
It's, to the best of our knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's, to the best of our knowledge, I'm Ann Strainchamps, coming to you from the Majestic Theater in Madison, Wisconsin. Today, what science and evolution can teach us about love. So now that we've got sex out of the way, let's move on to romance. Do you remember what it's like to fall in love? That slow process of getting to know someone, sharing secrets, telling histories, one conversation after another. It feels like magic. But 20 years ago, A psychologist named Arthur Aaron figured out how to make that happen, or at least something like it, between two strangers in a lab. Here's how it works. Two people walk into a lab. Sounds like the beginning of a joke, doesn't it? Each is told that the other one knows a little bit about them and is interested in meeting them. They sit across from each other and they're handed a list of 36 questions. And for the next roughly hour, they ask and answer each other those questions. Now, Arthur has done this experiment with hundreds of people over and over again, and almost all of the people say at the end of the activity, they feel almost as close to that stranger as they do to the closest people in their lives. So you want to know, I want to know, what are those questions?
Given the choice of anyone in the world, whom would you want as a dinner guest?
Would you like to be famous? In what way?
Before making a telephone call, do you ever rehearse what you're going to say?
What would constitute a perfect day for you?
When did you last sing to yourself?
Or to someone else?
If you were able to live to the age of 90 and retain either the mind or body of a 30-year-old for the last 60 years of your life, which would you want?
Is there something you've dreamed of doing for a long time? Why haven't you done it?
What does friendship mean to you?
What roles do love and affection play in your life?
How close and warm is your family?
Of all the people in your family, whose death would you find the most disturbing?
How do you feel about your relationship with your mother?
What if anything is too serious to be joked about?
When did you last cry in front of another person?
Or by yourself?
If you were to die this evening with no opportunity to communicate with anyone,
what would you most regret not having told someone?
Why haven't you told them yet?
So those are some questions, huh? And some of them I haven't even asked myself, let alone people I love. So you can see how those questions foster intimacy, which is what they're designed to do in the lab. But some people who have used these questions have actually fallen in love after using them, including writer Mandy Lynn Catron. She tried them on a first date.
We were at a bar in Vancouver. We had been at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and we went out for beer after, and we were just sort of chatting about relationships. And he was saying, I have this theory that you could fall in love with anyone, you know, assuming you have a certain number of common interests. And then I remember this study, and I said, well, actually, you know, someone has tried to make people fall in love in the lab, and said, you know, I've always wanted to try it. And he was like, let's do it. And so we did.
So they spent a few hours in that bar, hanging out together, asking each other questions, and they both felt like something happened, something changed.
I did feel like I went from not really knowing this person to knowing him quite well over just a few hours. I think it would be hard to really honestly answer the questions and not feel that way.
And then Mandy remembered that there's a second part to that experiment, a part that's kind of the clincher.
The second component of the study is that you stare into each other's eyes without speaking for 4 minutes. And he was like, well, like, do you think maybe we should do that too? And I kind of hesitated. So we walked down the street to the bridge because we wanted to go somewhere that wasn't too crowded. And you just have to be kind of brave to just let someone look at you for that amount of time. I mean, at least the first couple of minutes were pretty uncomfortable. You sort of drift out of that sense of like looking into someone's soul or whatever into just sort of being really present in the moment. And I don't know, other people would probably have different experiences, but that was mine.
Mandy Lynn Catron wrote about that experience in a Modern Love column for the New York Times, and she's got a book about it coming out this spring. It's called How to Fall in Love with Anyone, and that is how we make radio. Except the secret is how we make radio. We've got a really kick-ass audio engineer, technical director. So let's have a hand for Joe Hartke. Now, usually by the time you get to your teenage years, you have a pretty good idea, maybe not of who you're going to fall for, but at least what gender. A few people are bisexual, but pretty much we identify as gay or straight. But psychologist Lisa Diamond says that, in fact, most of us are a whole lot less fixed than we think. And the title of her book says it all, Sexual Fluidity, Understanding Women's Love and Desire. Welcome with me, please, Lisa Diamond. Hey, Lisa, thank you so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Although I want to correct something that you said.
Okay.
You said
a few people
are bisexual, but most folks are gay or straight. That's what most of us used to think because we didn't have very good data. But now we have a number of large, random, representative surveys that have been done on people's sexual attractions. And actually, bisexual patterns of attraction are far more common than exclusively gay or lesbian patterns
of
attraction.
Oh, you just cut to the chase entirely. So there you go, we're done.
The heterosexuals are still winning, but it's heterosexuals first, and then the bisexuals, and then the exclusive gays and lesbians.
Okay, so back up and let's figure out how you got to that point. So 20 years ago now, right, that you started doing this big survey, and you should explain this, but it was you were looking at non-heterosexual women and their sexual orientation, sex lives, desire.
Yeah, at the time I started the study, it was the early 90s. Most of the research on sexual identity development in young people was done on samples of men. So we ended up producing a whole science of men because it was easier to find them. So when I started graduate school, I was like, well, you know, I'm a lesbian, I'm a feminist, I'm going to study women, you know. So I didn't quite know what I was looking for, but I knew I wanted to follow women over time. And what I found was that as I tracked women's sexual attractions and sexual identities over time, regardless of where they started, whether they were lesbian or bisexual, or some of the women were like, well, I don't know what I am, but I'm somewhere, there was a lot of movement as time went on that some of the women who started out as lesbian ended up falling in love with their male best friends and getting involved with them. Some of the women who were predominantly bisexual then ended up switching to be exclusively lesbian. And I just found that there was a lot more flexibility in women's sexuality than most of the literature at that time had suggested.
So were you surprised?
I was very surprised. And initially, I thought, well, you know, they're still young. Give them a little few more years and
everyone
will settle down. And yet I found that the longer I followed them, the more women started to change. So that by the time I reached the 10-year point, and now I'm at the 20-year point, change is substantially more common than stability.
So how do you explain this? Because it goes against everything we're taught and everything we think.
We think
we're supposed to settle into a sexual identity and, oh, I'm only attracted to men or only to women.
And I think that's because most of the other research tended to look at people at one point in time. And if you capture anyone at one point in time, they may feel pretty certain that where they are is where they are, right? And so if they're, you know, heterosexual, they're like, well, I'm heterosexual. That's who I am. The trick comes when you let their lives unfold. And most of our lives are a lot more complex than we think. And it looks like our human species just has a lot more capacity for fluidity and for plasticity than most of us imagine.
So I have to ask, was there a personal component for you of starting to do this research? I mean, you came out, what, in your college years?
I came out in my college years, and there wasn't so much of a personal component. I mean, I certainly wasn't looking for sexual fluidity. I was just a garden variety lesbian when I started doing this research, a good, plain, old, boring lesbian. And
did the research inspire you to become a more interesting experimentalist?
Unfortunately, it has, and sometimes I feel bad because I've been asked to speak to a lot of bisexual organizations because I've been a big advocate for more research on bisexuality because it is just so much more common than exclusive same-sex sexuality. And often I feel a need to confess to the organizers, like, I'm actually a lesbian. I'm sorry. Like, I'm like the greatest champion of bisexuals that you can find, but I'm not a bisexual. And they're like, it's okay, you know, we need the lesbians to stand up for us.
But the story you're telling, I mean, you don't know, right?
I mean, exactly. You know, I should be the first person to say, like, I'm a lesbian now. Who the hell knows? But, you know, I've also been married to the same woman for 22 years.
So we were talking about women. What about men? Is the same thing true? Are men as sexually fluid as women?
I used to think that women were much more fluid than men. And my thoughts on that have really started to change. I started to do more research on men. And I did a study, you know, in Salt Lake City, where you would think the men would be pretty rigid. And I found a really surprising degree of fluidity in men's attractions as well. Gay-identified men reporting that they frequently masturbate to fantasies of women, and straight-identified men saying that they, you know, had some sort of oral sex with a man in the past 12 months. So even in men, I think the boundaries aren't as rigid as they used to be. I think one of the reasons it looks like it's more common in women is that I think we give women in our culture more permission to be affectionate with other women, to have close relationships with other women that might spill over into unusual affection. And I think we have been more rigid with men that, you know, men have to be men, and if men are gonna have close emotional relationships, they're gonna be with women and not with other men. But some of those norms are changing, and I think men have more permission now to, you know, explore intimacy in a variety of ways with both male and female friends. So I think we'll find out in like another 10, 15 years, you know, how much fluidity differs between women and men. Maybe the culture will have caught up for men as well as women.
Have you translated any of this into figures? Like, if you had to guess, what percentage of the general population would be fluid?
I get that question a lot, and it's hard to know. One thing we do know is that because we have good nationally representative data on just the percentage of individuals who report any degree of same-sex attraction at all. And the most recent data on that suggests that about 14% of women and about 10% of men report some degree of same-sex attraction. And in both women and men, the vast majority of those individuals describe themselves as mostly but not completely heterosexual. So that the largest group of individuals walking around with same-sex attractions are individuals who you would never know had same-sex attractions. They identify as heterosexual. They think they're mainly heterosexual, but they're like heteroflexible, right? So they're the majority of individuals with same-sex attractions, and yet historically they've been completely invisible. We only now are starting to see what a big group they are. And they're not just a big group in the US. You find the same thing if you look at Great Britain, France, the Netherlands. The heteroflexibles are like this huge looming population.
Does this change anything about what we think about, what we know about the nature of desire? Why, how we fall in love with the people we fall in love with?
I think it just shows us that as a species, flexibility is our hallmark. There are a lot of animal species in which the process of selecting a mate and going about sex is very rigidly channeled. In some species, it only happens when you're capable of reproducing. One of the things about humans with our huge brains and our huge social systems is that we go about the process of affiliation and attachment and bonding and sex in really complex social ways. And we use sexuality for purposes of affiliation, and we use affiliation for the purposes of mating, that there are sort of cross currents between love and attachment and friendship and sexuality that are a lot more complicated than they are in other species because of our huge social groups and because of our huge social brains. And therefore, we should expect that these are flexible processes that we can tweak in a number of ways.
But I thought that the whole purpose in evolution, the purpose of sex and love really is to reproduce.
And we do that very successfully. But not only do we need to reproduce, but we also need to care for our children. Some scholars have suggested that the fact that humans often historically have relied on other adults in the social group to help care for our children makes it really, really important to have intimate, close, trusting bonds with other individuals in your social network. Some have suggested that sexual fluidity might serve that purpose. Now, I'm not sure whether the best way to get your neighbor to help care for your kids is to have sex with your neighbor.
Is to sleep with her?
But, you know, Maybe. But again, the idea
so
is that,
for babysitting.
That our lives are complex enough so that it's not just a matter of meet, have sex, spit the kid out, but that we have always reproduced in a large social context in which our relations with other members of the social group are a key part of our reproductive success.
Mm. One last question. We haven't talked about the politics of this, but it strikes me that there would be some interesting political implications, because if you're saying that, nope, sorry, it's not just you were born that way, any of us could be that way.
And that,
what does that do for civil rights?
This is a huge issue, and in fact, there were friend of the court briefs filed in the same-sex marriage cases by individuals opposed to same-sex marriage that actually cited my own work as evidence that, you know, LGBT individuals didn't constitute a discrete group that warranted equal protection status because sexuality was so fluid. So
how
no one was being discriminated.
That?
I was rather distressed by it, as you might imagine. And I had the chance to, you know, file briefs saying that I disagreed with that point of view. But when it came down to it, the sort of fixedness, the immutability of sexual orientation, this notion that, oh, we deserve these rights because we're born this way, that has actually not played really any significant role in any of the judicial rulings on the rights of LGBT individuals for quite some time. Courts have basically said it's not the immutability of a trait that matters. It's whether laws forbidding certain conduct are motivated by hatred or animus. And so we really don't need to argue that we're born a certain way and that we're fixed and that we're, you know, permanently channeled in order to advocate for civil rights. And what I've always, you know, said to this is it doesn't matter how or why you came to want to have sex with a certain type of person or marry them. Either we're a society that protects your sexual freedom and your liberty to choose your marital partner, or we're not. And you have to make the decision on that basis.
Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
Lisa Diamond is a professor of psychology and gender studies at the University of Utah, and you can read more about her research in her book, Sexual Fluidity: Understanding Women's Love and Desire.
Good evening, everybody. How are we doing tonight? Yeah. My name is Esteban Tuma. I'm a comedian from Ecuador. If you don't know how to call people from Ecuador, we're called Ecuadorables. So the Ecuadorable performer of the night. Thank you very much. Love and evolution. I believe in evolution. I believe in love too. Yes, I believe in love too. I don't believe in marriage though. I don't. I feel it's a phony institution. My wife, she agrees. She says that marriage eliminates your ability to state your own opinions. And I have to agree. I have to agree. She's here, so I have to. We were one of those couples that didn't want to get married. You know, we were like, we don't need a piece of paper to be together. We don't need a piece of paper to love each other. And then the U.S. government was like, nah, yeah, you do. You do. So we got married. And it's true what they say about marriage. Marriage is tough. It's complicated. And you have to fight for it. Sometimes you want to be alone. Sometimes there's drama. But then you get home, and you sit next to her, and you look at her in her eyes, and you think, this woman, this other human being is the only reason why I have a green card. So you make it work. You make it work. Gotta do it. It's just the two of us. No kids. We don't have kids. We don't want kids. And a lot of people tell me, Esteban, you don't want kids? Don't you know that a life without a baby is a life without meaning? And I think that might be true, but I also feel that a life with a baby is two lives without meaning, so. Who's going to take care of you when you're old? professional team of healthcare physicians. Like, gonna be cheaper than college for sure, so. There you go. So yeah, I love certain things. I love flying into the United States. Oh, favorite pastime. I'm half Hispanic, half Palestinian, so. I get premier platinum access to all major US airport basements. It's amazing, amazing. As soon as they see my passport, they're like, right this way, sir. We're gonna repack your bags and fondle your testicles. Yes. Sky Mile Priority waterboarding. Oh, awesome. Sounds perfect. It happened this last time. I was flying back from Ecuador recently, and I was going through the whole YMCA machine, and the TSA agent's like, sir? And this is a direct quote from a TSA agent. He says, sir, I believe we have found something potentially dangerous in your groin area. I was like, I know. My wife here knows how to activate it. She jumps in and says, yeah, it goes off in under a minute. So that's my relationship with my wife. Don't feel sorry for me. It's not true. It's a joke. We have a good time. We have fun. But I like other I like things. I love things that Americans don't seem to like. You guys don't like soccer. And I don't understand why. I feel like I'm getting it, though, now. I feel like you guys don't like soccer just because the rest of the world loves it. I don't understand why you guys are not fascinated with squirrels. Nothing captures the mystery of evolution like squirrels. Their tails are a question mark. And the question is, where do they poop? Have you ever seen a squirrel poop? I've never seen little nutty brown turd. No. It's crazy. But what fascinates me the most about squirrels is that they seem to have one thought in their mind, and one thought only. Holy shit, don't die! That's it. That's it. Their entire existence is driven by the fact that something is going to kill them. And then something does. That is amazing. Isn't that what drives love and evolution at the end, right? That's my time, guys. Thank you very much.
Esteban Tuma. He is a comedian and professor of Spanish at Madison College. And check out his show, Stand Up Democracy, on Facebook. And we get another song.
Hanging around all tight-lipped, so the words don't slip, the meanings never fade, and I can't say what I'm trying to say. You tried to say, and I tried to say, we can't articulate the greatest things. I am convinced cannot be said, cannot be said. And I know one day, I know, we will open up our throats and it won't. And it won't come out myself anymore.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps, coming to you from the Majestic Theater in Madison, Wisconsin. Today, what science and evolution can teach us about love. So, we've talked about sex, we've talked about romantic love and desire, but there are other kinds of love. In fact, the ancient Greeks identified and named six types
Eros, sexual passion, we covered that. Philia, deep, devoted friendship. Ludus, playful love, dancing, laughing with friends, playing with kids. Pragma, mature love of long-standing committed partners. Philautia, self-love or self-compassion. And most radical of all, agape, selfless, compassionate love for everyone, which I think we would all like to see more of in the world. So let me introduce Steve Paulson together with our two next guests, Jeff Schloss and David Sloan Wilson.
Okay, picture this scene. You're at the beach, down by the water. It's a windy day. The current is strong. In fact, you know the riptide could suck you right out to sea. And then you see a kid way out there screaming, and there's no one else around. You are the only one who could possibly save him, but you don't even know if you could. So what do you do? Well, we know that some people will take extraordinary risks to help total strangers. And the question is, why? And for scientists, this poses a real challenge for any theory of altruism. I mean, there is no evolutionary reason why I should swim out to try to rescue that kid. At least, I don't think there is. So can science explain why we want to help other people? And to get back to our theme for this show, are these acts of compassion also experiences of love? Well, lucky for us, we have two distinguished guests here to help us sort out these thorny questions. Both are evolutionary biologists. Jeff Schloss is a senior scholar at the BioLogos Foundation, and David Sloan Wilson is president of the Evolution Institute. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, you have both spent years studying the science of altruism. So Jeff, let me start with you. Is altruism a form of love?
Well, I think if it's the case that, as some of our colleagues were saying 20 years ago, genuine altruism, sacrificing for the well-being of another, was somehow biologically impossible, that love would be in real trouble. But I don't think it's the same as love, because in addition to...
You're blowing the whole thesis for our interview here, but no, go ahead.
I think it's a necessary component of love. Investing in the well-being of another, what could be more important? Well, also important is cherishing and delighting in the being of another. So this Greek notion of agape actually involved both. It involved investing in the flourishing of another, giving when others are in need, but also even if they're not in need, just basking in the beauty of their presence. As we heard in talks on romance, for example. Well, we also have that in friendship and other relationships.
Okay, so maybe we need to sort of dig into these definitions a little bit. David, how would you define what altruism is?
Well, in modern life, we find it difficult to imagine how much people worked in groups and the importance of groups in our ancestral past. We lived in small groups and the dependency upon each other, especially in emergency situations such as warfare and so on, was extreme. And so the idea that we evolved basically to function in groups and to help each other in those situations should be no surprise at all.
Well, what about helping total strangers, though?
Total strangers are a bit more problematic. And so for that reason, we see it's not that common. It's the rare individual that does that. I think what Lisa said about fluidity goes way beyond sexual fluidity in terms of our capacity to help or not help is richly contextual, basically, and much depends upon the context.
The question that we're asking here is, what's the connection between love and evolution? And there's a profound question. How much can evolutionary science explain what love is, why we love?
Jeff? That's such a silly question, I'm going to have Jeff answer.
Well, I love your story that you opened with, saving the drowning child. And, you know, that brings to mind a story that is kind of iconic in evolutionary biologist circles. The biologist, J.V.S. Haldane, has famously said, doodling on a pub, so the story goes, in a napkin one night, I'll gladly give my life, jump into the river for two brothers or eight cousins. So that kind of sacrifice on behalf of kin makes sense. And David has argued that, well, also sacrifice on behalf of group members makes sense as well. Now you ask, well, how about strangers? Well, you could have a stranger that's a recognizable member of our group. The policeman or fireman who drove into the river in New York and became famous years ago. The really tough thing to explain is not just sacrificing our strangers who are identifiable members of our group, but how about loving and sacrificing for out-group, for those we might identify as enemies?
So really what you're saying is, I mean, the thing that drives evolution, one of the things that drives evolution is the group. I mean, this group identity, you're kind of either in the group or out of the group. You'll go a long way to help those who are in the group. But those outside the group, that's just tough luck, right? I mean, you might actually want to kill them.
In a way. And yet, again, we need to look at the diversity of things. If you look at species, there's all kinds of relationships. There are competitors, predators, parasites, mutualists. They might coexist without interacting. The same is true of human groups. They can be predatory, competitive, parasitic, mutualistic, trade, or they might coexist without interacting with each other. And so what we need to do is we need to think of love and its alternatives as alternative social strategies which might succeed or fail depending upon the circumstances. And so if we want love to succeed, and if we want it to succeed at a certain scale, then the answer is that we can do that. And that can be the chosen strategy by evolution, but only if we structure our environments in the right way. And if we don't, then evolution takes us where we don't want to go.
And returning to David's point about fluidity, one of the remarkable things about evolution is that it doesn't just happen at the level of the genome and what we might be kind of innately disposed to do. Evolution also happens culturally. So even if it's true that we're more disposed to love and care for those people who are members of our group, there are no fixed boundaries on what constitutes a group. And if you look at human societies over the course of history, group boundaries have expanded. And who falls within the domain of moral concern? I find this really encouraging.
You know,
has also expanded.
I have to say, I mean, you're both talking about how evolution can happen at this group level, which, at least not that long ago, was kind of a controversial idea. I mean, Richard Dawkins wrote this famous book, The Selfish Gene. He said evolution happens at the level of the gene, maybe at the level of the organism, not groups. What's going on here?
Well, Richard Dawkins was just plain wrong, what can I say?
Do you want to just elaborate briefly on this?
Well, I mean, I have a mantra with my namesake, Edward O. Wilson. Selfishness beats altruism within groups. Altruistic groups beat selfish groups. Everything else is commentary. The idea that at the end of the day, whatever evolves is the gene has the genes for whatever evolves. If you want to call them selfish, be my guest. But the fact is that what we would call altruistic behaviorally then is something which can evolve as long as that process of groups doing better than other groups outweighs the process of individuals doing better than other individuals within groups. We have one force weighing in favor of selfishness, another force weighing in favor of altruism, and then which wins depends on their strength, and that's why we see both altruism and selfishness in nature. This is something really which is a done deal as far as my colleagues are concerned, and some people will go to their graves without accepting it, including my
Professor Dawkins just hasn't gotten the message yet, so. Are you both really trying to tell me that evolutionary science can explain all facets of love?
Yes.
David and I are friends, by the way, but he's just really wrong on that. No, it depends what you mean by explain, right? So if we're trying to think in terms of the way our embodiment in biological organisms gives rise and supports to our cognitive and affective capacities for love, we better have evolution be part of that story, as well as for cognitive science and neurophysiology and endocrinology. But there are other aspects of understanding things, right? Both David and I have also been interested in humor. David's written papers on humor. Now, can evolution help us understand humor? Absolutely. Could all the understanding in the world ever help somebody get a joke if they just didn't have a sense of humor? No. You have to explain a joke, usually by without recourse to evolutionary theory. And then one more step. What if you studied humor aside from an evolutionary standpoint and you got the structure of jokes and why things were funny, but you'd never actually laughed? Would you understand humor? So I want to say causal explanation, yeah, evolution and a bunch of other sciences. But understanding what it really is to love, no.
Okay, we get your answer. Yeah. No, evolutionary science cannot explain all aspects of love. David, do you want to present the contrarian point of view here?
Well, I think that the subjective experience, I think, is something that might be ineffable. But in other respects, I think, of course, there's this thing called methodological naturalism. Can we explain what we see, everything that we see, in terms of the natural laws acting around us? This is what Darwin did and what he strived to do with his theory of evolution. And so much, especially with a topic such as altruism, it seemed that evolution explains selfishness well, but has difficulty explaining altruism. And I think that what we now know is that evolution has the resources to explain both selfishness and altruism. Thank you very much. It also has the resources to explain the psychological aspects of altruism, not just the actions, but basically the feelings also to a degree. And so even if it remains true that I can't, that the subjective experience might be ineffable, in every other respect, I would say all aspects of all humanity, therefore love, falls within the orbit of evolutionary theory.
Now, David, we were talking the other day, and you said something that I've been mulling over ever since. You said the critical question is, how can it be safe to love?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. And when you look at the groups that work well, they are well protected against selfishness. They have, basically, they have norms and other aspects about them that make it difficult to be selfish. And in a situation like that, then we can, when we're in that situation, then we feel safe to express our pro-social natures. And if that's not the case, if we're in a vulnerable situation, then like any good turtle or snail, we know how to pull into our shells. So that's the sense in which love needs something other than love. Love needs basically tough love.
So you're basically saying that it can be dangerous to love. I mean, if it can be dangerous to just be too giving if you're not around other people.
Oh, absolutely. A wonderful person is Adam Grant. He's a business professor at the Wharton School, wrote a book called Give and Take. He says there's three kinds of people. There's givers, takers, and reciprocators. Who do you think does best in the business world? The answer is the givers do the best and the worst. Because the givers in the business world who manage to surround themselves with other givers, they do spectacular things. But if they don't, and they get surrounded by takers, then they become chumps and doormats. And so with altruism, there's always that problem, that if you can find other altruists, then you do spectacularly. If you don't, then you become chump and a doormat. That's the good news and the bad news associated with altruism and love. And so if you want love to thrive, just structure the world so that basically that loving people can find each other and avoid the depredations of the not so loving.
You know, that kind of, wonderful. C.S. Lewis says that the only place short of heaven where we don't face the risks of love is hell. In the latter place, there is no love. And whatever you think about the metaphysical implications of that statement, it's true. And not just altruism, but falling in love. Every domain of love has its risks. But one of the things that, I don't know about you, but for me, oftentimes what kindles a friendship is the discovery of a shared love that we each have. It can be something as simple as a kindred sense of humor, or, wow, you like that musical artist that nobody else likes. And this relates to actually identifying in another a kindred disposition that that fosters the willingness to take the risk of trust.
So we've been talking about groups, the power of groups, and you're saying, I mean, the message I'm getting here is, you know, find a group where, you know, there are a bunch of altruists there, and, you know, I'm probably going to be a little happier. I guess the question is, how big can the group get to be altruistic? I mean, one of the stories of human evolution is, you know, we used to be hunter-gatherers. We had these small clans. Everyone knew each other, and, you know, cities came along. People are living in these much larger communities and nations. How big can the group get and still be loving?
I think there's two answers to that question. One is that the small group is the natural human social environment. And so get you to a small group where people are, where you're doing meaningful things and you can be known by your actions. If you do that, then two things will happen. First of all, you will thrive as an individual. And secondly, as a group, you will be more efficacious than as an individual. But of course, that's not good enough. Those groups have to be formed into something larger. And 10,000 years of cultural evolution have resulted in large-scale societies that work remarkably well, remarkably cooperative. And so these mechanisms for functioning well at a large scale have evolved, but of course they need to be pushed further. And so really the biggest group must be the Earth, and then that group must be multicellular. It must be composed of smaller units, including the cell in which we can thrive as individuals.
Wait, are you saying that we need some sort of planetary love?
Absolutely. I think that we need to be planetary altruists, but that's not good enough by itself because it has to be organized at every level. So really, when you think of the concept of a superorganism and a planetary superorganism, what that means, just think of what a real organism is and all the many, many regulatory processes that take place in a real organism, that's what has to take at the planetary scale. It is, of course, a daunting proposition, but it is what needs to be done.
I'm wondering whether this is just the ravings of an idealistic evolutionary biologist here, or I mean, is this possible, what you're calling for, planetary love, Jeff?
Well, it's possible, but I think you have to keep in mind the key distinction that David made, that you need a core group, too. And this gets back to the question you opened us with. Altruism, investing in the flourishing of the whole is important, but that doesn't work unless there's some affective attachment, some bonding, some cherishing. So even David's point about caring for the planet, it's hard for me to imagine people caring for the planet if they haven't fallen in love with the lake in their backyard. But nevertheless, and sustaining that moral commitment to the flourishing of the whole, it's hard to imagine that working unless those of us in this room know how to care for one another and delight in one another, eyeball to eyeball.
Well, I was hoping we could take this conversation bigger and have a bigger idea of love. Thank you very much, both of you.
That was Steve Paulson talking with Jeff Schloss, who's a senior scholar at the BioLogos Foundation and a biologist at Westmont College, and David Sloan Wilson, president of the Evolution Institute and professor of biology and anthropology at SUNY Binghamton. So we've had an evening of talking about love and evolution. And our purpose, if you know this show, as always, is to animate some big questions. To the Best of Our Knowledge is a show that believes in questions more than answers. So I hope that we leave you this evening curious or wanting to know more. But something else happened here tonight. I mean, look around. A room full of people came out on a cold winter night in Madison, Wisconsin, to talk about love and romance and compassion. We invoked, we conjured love. But the point is to feel it, share it, bring it, grow it. So here's one way. Go home and think about what puts love in your life. Where do you find it? Big moments and small moments. A dog happy to have a walk. A cup of coffee on a cold morning. A smile when you need one.
This week, our staff started building a giant online photo collage. These are pictures of the people, places, and things that fill our lives with love, and we'd like to invite you to join us. Post your photos, your thoughts on Instagram, hashtag TTBook, or send email to listener@ttbook.org. And here I want to thank also the Center for Humans and Nature for partnering with us on this event. We are so happy to have worked with you. The event was also made possible by generous support from the John Templeton Foundation. Thanks to Wisconsin Public Radio for 26 years of support. Thanks to the staff of Wisconsin Public Television for filming tonight. Madison's Guild of Typewriter Poets, who have been here all night writing spontaneous love poems on demand. Thank you to our one-man house band, Asumaya. And finally, it takes a lot of people to make a radio show, and it takes even more to put it on stage. Tonight's show is produced by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Raymond Tungekar. Thanks to our event fixer, Chris Myshock. Our technical director is the inimitable Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. I'm Ann Strangechamps. Last thing I say every hour, it's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.